I'm Francis Nataf, and we're going to speak about the argument for radical curricular change in contemporary Jewish schools. I think that was the full title. I don't know who's in the room. I'm not going to take the time to ask, because I don't want to take time away from the class, even though it is important. I presume that a number of you are Tanakh teachers, and certainly people who are interested in Tanakh. I just came back from San Francisco. I mean, I live in Israel. I came back from San Francisco, and assuming that many of you are Tanakh teachers, or at least people who are, let's say, pro-Tanakh, that on some level, arguing for curricular change is like arguing for gay rights in San Francisco. I can't even say Lahavdil in this particular situation. And on some level, we can almost say, well, duh, and leave it at that, because I'm sure the fact that you're here may likely indicate a sense that there's a major problem in Jewish studies curriculum or curricula in our schools. I'm going to focus on what I think is the most problematic area, and that's in boys, young men's education, let's say from junior high school through high school through the Beit Midrash setting. And again, I assume you anticipate the issue that we know that in that setting there's a preponderance of hours and effort and emphasis on the study of Talmud as opposed to other subjects. And it's interesting that we meet in Mayanot where there is, among many other schools, where there is an idea that the girls' curriculum should imitate on some level the boys' curriculum, which I find problematic because it assumes that the boys' curriculum is somehow more shalem, shall we say, somehow more productive than the women's curriculum, which, as we will discuss, I think is not at all the case. I was told yesterday in conversation that I forgot who it was. I think Moshe Sokol, if I'm not mistaken, when they started the drive for women to learn Gemara, also he made the comment that so now no one will be able to learn Tanakh. So Baruch Hashem, we have meetings like Yamei Iyun that help maintain the study of Tanakh. I think there's certainly a renaissance. That this is only part of the renaissance, certainly in Israel, but here also there's a renaissance in Tanakh learning. Yeah?
I think the argument of those who study Talmud always say they learn Tanakh from Talmud.
Right. Now the Tosfot said that you get your Tanakh by the various verses that are cited. I think, and it has been argued, that Tosfot was assuming that you already learned through Tanakh and that the rest of your life you would still have contact with Tanakh after you'd already mastered it. But people may still use the argument in such a way, I don't know. In any case, what we, I think, have to start with is the understanding that our schools, for better or worse, model their curricula based on the Lithuanian yeshiva system, the Lithuanian yeshiva model. I call it the neo-yeshiva model. There are obvious adjustments that are made, certainly in terms of the breadth of study. In Volozhin, I understand that the yeshiva would go through several mesechtot during the course of the year, where even in Beit Midrash, forget about high school, where it's very difficult for, especially in the American context, to accomplish a lot. But even in Beit Midrash, most places, although there's some change recently, but most places will learn 10 pages during the course of the year. So there are certain adjustments, and usually the adjustments are counter-adaptive rather than adaptive adjustments. But in any case, the model that we use is very much the Lithuanian approach to Jewish education. And we have to focus, I think, first of all, on the differences that exist between the context of Lithuanian yeshivot, and our context in the contemporary world, both here in Israel, Europe, and anywhere that Jewish communities exist in significant numbers. The first thing that I think it's important to point out is that the yeshivot in Lita, as well as in other places, were elite institutions. They were not meant for the masses. What we are dealing with today is mass education. Again, for better or for worse, that is the context in which we find ourselves. And everybody goes to yeshiva high school. If you're religious on any serious level, and obviously that's a certain value judgment, but I think most of us would agree, that you will be going, or you're sending your children to some type of yeshiva high school, be they boys or girls. As a result, you're dealing with all sorts of learning styles, you're dealing with all sorts of vocational interests, you're dealing with all sorts of intellectual aptitudes. In the Lithuanian yeshivot, you had a much more monolithic group of highly talented individuals with certain expectations, with certain views, wherein it was much easier to accomplish the goals of the yeshiva. Also important to understand is that the yeshiva system is based on a certain philosophy. In other words, it's not Torah Mi-Sinai that the highest way to achieve communion with God is through intensive Talmud Torah, and specifically in this fashion. If anybody wants to get greater understanding of this approach, I would recommend more than anything else the Nefesh HaChaim of Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Essentially, the Hashkafah has its roots, I mean its real roots, and obviously there's something in Chazal and in Kabbalah, but the real roots are the Gra, and Rav Chaim Volozhiner is the student of the Gra, and creates a mystical understanding of what Talmud Torah is all about, wherein it takes on its primary importance. I think it's important to realize that's not the only Hashkafah, even though again as a result of our adapting the yeshiva model, that Hashkafah has gained a certain mass popularity in perhaps as a result of our schools. And the third thing is the idea of the Talmid Chacham, or the creating of Gdolei Torah, as a primary goal, for which we're willing to make great sacrifices. There's a very interesting letter of Rav Dessler, Rav Eliyahu Dessler, in I think the third volume of Miktav Eliyahu, in the very back, he has letters. He writes arguing against the approach of Torah and Derech Eretz. And in the letter, he says there are going to be many korbanot. He doesn't say those words exactly, but that's essentially what he says. There are going to be many korbanot as a result of the yeshiva system. I mean, there are people that will drop their religiosity altogether. But the price is worth it because it's the only way to bring about Gedolei Torah. In other words, his argument, or his evaluation, Rav Dessler's evaluation, is there were two competing systems in his mind. There was a Torah Derech Eretz approach, and there was the Lithuanian yeshiva model. Rav Dessler is mode, whether he had to be or not, there were those that would argue, but Rav Dessler, for his sake, personally, agreed that the Torah Derech Eretz approach was more successful for the masses. In other words, less people would drop out. Right? The average student would find their place more readily in the Torah Derech Eretz approach of Shem Shalom Foley Hirsch. However, the drawback was, he felt, that Gedolei Torah were not formed by this approach, and that was his evaluation of the German situation. Right, the interlocutor, or at least the theoretical, I think he's actually the actual interlocutor, is the Sri De Eish. Right? He's really arguing this situation of the Sri De Eish, who was in Montreux and adapted to Der Acheretz, and as a result of the adaptation, he himself was from Eastern Europe, adopted the system, fought for it, and saw it really dwindling in Eretz Israel, and became very depressed about it in his latter years. But be that as it may, there's this argument that goes on between the two of them, where there's an agreement between the two of them that there's an upside and a downside from each approach. And Rav Dessler points out the primacy of creating Talmidei Chachamim is worth the price of the fallouts, the people that will be actually pushed away as a result of the rigor and the demands of the yeshiva system. It's interesting that this approach, the Lithuanian model, was not what you always found on these shores, nor universally. It's not, I mean, there are three, in my mind, there are three central figures in the popularizing of that approach. And one has to readily admit that there will have been many accomplishments of that approach as well. We'll get to that in a minute. But I would say that in Israel, the Chazon Ish is perhaps the most central figure of promoting that approach in Israel on a high level, but what you start on a high level dwindles down on a lower level as well. One could say Rav Neria as well, but in the United States, certainly we have Rav Aaron Cutler as well as Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav also. Those of us who went through YU would readily admit that ultimately what you have is a Lithuanian yeshiva. I mean, there's all sorts of other things going on. There's a university, there's a diverse hashkafa, but the approach to learning, the hashkafa, is very much in line with what you see in the Nefesh HaChaim. And in fact, my reading, there are many reasons, I'm certainly not an expert on the Rav, but my reading of Halachic Man is very much an updated version of the Nefesh HaChaim, very much in line with the centrality of Talmud Torah as the primary approach to Dveikut with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In any case, these are issues that I think it's important to be aware of, and I'm starting with this to tell us where we are. And I don't think it's where we should be. I think the major problem is that we rarely step back courageously to analyze what it is we want from our students.
Excuse me, can you just step back for one moment to the point where you're talking about the high school today? You said the high school today has become much more for the masses.
Right.
Right? What happens after high school in the base medrash? Who won there? Is it a Lipish program? Is it more for the elites? Or is it also masses?
I don't have the demographics, but the word on the streets is that anybody who's anybody goes on to Beit Midrash. The year in Israel has become, you know, something that if you're serious on any level, you have to do. I mean, right now the year and a half, I hear, is the standard as opposed to the year. What's interesting is what's happened. It used to be when the year in Israel was first starting out, that it was an elite phenomenon. I don't know if you went to Israel way back when there was the beginning. Some of you might have done so. The average fellow did not do that, and therefore was perhaps more appropriate. Let's say perhaps 20 years ago, certainly 15 years ago, it was de rigueur that spent at least 1 year, and therefore the elite was the people who spent Shana Bet. That was an elite situation, but the first year. And now we have the average guy spending a year and a half, so that if you're elite, you spend 2 to 2.5 years, or 3 or 4, whatever it is. Be that as it may, I think it's critical, and perhaps if you get nothing out of my presentation, one thing that I would like to communicate is the need for significant work on mission statements, and from mission statements, serious work to implement the mission statements. Yeah.
In, I guess it would be pretty much the late 50s, early 60s when yeshiva high schools were starting to develop larger numbers there. Was there a deliberate decision that the Lithuanian model was a success and that's why we should copy it?
Yeah.
Or was it that's all we knew?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think it was deliberate. I think unfortunately, most things in the Jewish world are not very deliberate. And it's precisely what I'm arguing is that at this point, we do need to be deliberate and analyze whether there are other options available to us. I think, again, the leaders that I mentioned assumed that the Lithuanian model was really the only seriously successful model. By the way, I'm going to go back to the point about the mission statement because I think it's critical, but before I go on, I think it's only fair to mention that there has been a measure of success that can be attributed to the yeshiva model. In other words, before the war, before the Eastern European leaders came to these shores, the Jewish educational system in America was certainly nothing to write home about. Right? There was a certain intensity that was brought to Jewish studies that one can't deny. And certainly, you know, if you look at the level of observance we have now as opposed to 50 years ago, both in Israel as well as the United States, is largely due to the yeshiva model. But my question is not whether the yeshiva model has been successful, but rather, is it the most successful? Is it the best that we can do? Is it the most suited to meet our goals? And I think this is a question that simply doesn't get any airtime. One second. I remember with my students, with the David Cardoza Academy, we study the topic of Jewish education. One thing we did was to make a survey of mission statements. Many of them are not very good. Others are, but I have my doubts, even when they are good, that there's any serious implementation of it from what I see in the yeshiva high schools. Yeah, go ahead.
My reason for taking this course is because I'm also disenchanted with the present system in the fact that although it's successful to the extent that it is, but I see too many people that I tried to be makariv go on the wayside. And they seem to go on the wayside because somehow they don't seem to have the mind to absorb Gemara. In other words, they aren't philosophically oriented to be able to tolerate Gemara. And since they can't, and they're not rich enough to afford, let's say, I come from Brooklyn, so Yeshiva Flatbush. If they can't go to Yeshiva Flatbush, there's no other place that they can go if they need kiruv and if they're not interested in Gemara. And I have had probably more privately, I can tell you about the worst case scenario of a kid.
We've all heard them.
My most frightening, nightmarish case. But you know, just disenchantment with the present yeshiva system, and looking for something. There should be options, more options. Stressing Tanakh, stressing vocational, et cetera.
Sure. Ian, go ahead.
I'm sure you realize that about 50 years ago at Yeshiva University, there were two streams. One was Beth Midrash and Morim, which became ECA.
IBC.
And I can't follow it. IBC.
EMC, all sorts
where
of people.
Where was it Rit?
Yeah.
And I remember the teachers having trouble with COVID. Switching to Sfardit, I remember, Eretz Yisrael, etc. But in any event, there was a very broad base, including Tanakh, philosophy, etc. Talmud was taught by some wonderful, very, very perceptive Rabbanim, and those people who got through that, many went into the yeshiva stream then, except that they were looked down upon as shkutzim, frankly.
Right, sure.
And they couldn't find Chavrusas within Chief University because, you know, they hadn't been in the real
the stigma.
But in any event, anyone who's gone through that kind of education, getting the board base and learning Tanakh, and knowing, coming into Dr. Pinchas Kurian's class at Yeshayahu and learning Perek, you know, each time a Perek and knowing it by heart or whatever else it was, has a much different approach to learning, you know, to Jewish education, let's put it this way, than someone who has not had it. So there was within YU, there still is, but I don't know if it's written.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there have been attempts to try to create alternative and Masulim is a different models. But I think the immediate impetus is as you said, a growing dropout level. That's the immediate impetus, I think, for many of us to question whether the system is really functioning as well as we'd like. But what I think is it's really only an impetus and not really the problem itself. I don't think, the way I see the dropout problem is that you're dealing with the tip of the iceberg. And people estimate the dropout rate at 10%, which historically, well, whatever it is, is pretty good historically. It's gotten worse than it was a few years ago. But I think that the question is not so much are people staying religious as what type of religious Jews are we creating? Is halakha, is gemara providing the suitable religious drive that's needed for Ovdei Hashem? And ultimately, what are we trying to create? Are we trying to create people that are fluent in text? And one mission statement horrified me that said that that was the main goal. And it didn't say fluent in text, fluent in Hebrew, which, you know, I think Hebrew is very important. But to say that that's your ultimate goal, I personally would be embarrassed by such a mission statement. I mean, there was a certain principle that was associated with it, which is understandable, but I find that highly problematic. Again,
PLE.
Sorry?
Certain principle, PLE.
In PLE? Oh, as well as PAL. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but perhaps we're operating with a presumption that should be laid out as a more explicit card on the table, and that is that it is the school's sole responsibility for the upbringing of the religious generation that will continue to follow. I'd like to posit, I don't know if you find this a friendly amendment, but to contextualize the conversation, I've been arguing that there are at least three legs to the stool. One, of course, is the school, the other is the home, the other should be the shul, and then depending on if you want to break out youth groups, whether that's in the
sure.
school, that's the
sure.
third leg of the stool. Because one of the challenges, I think, is that the school often is charged with the academic responsibility mm-hmm. of education, and that often does mean textual study. Because whether it's singing in Zmiros or it's Kiruv and whatnot, that can be done off in the Shul youth group or it can be done outside in the Shul, ideally in the home. But if the home can't do the textual skill building, then that is the primary responsibility of the school. I think that's some of the tension and some of the mission statements you may be referring to. But I'm not sure if we're operating
okay, that's
the,
it's, yeah.
the school is uniquely charged with
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good question. I would agree on some level with the model. I think that one maximizes one's results by using all of those elements. And I, by the way, would say that youth group is, in fact, perhaps one of the stronger elements as opposed to the weaker element. And that next to the school is probably, in my mind, the most important. What I would disagree with is the division of labor that you present. Chaim Soloveitchik, in his famous article, Rupture and Reconstruction, argues, I think very convincingly, about the delegitimization of the home in our children's eyes. For whatever reason, certainly we should try to fight against it. The school, I think, has much more impact not only on a person's skill building, but more importantly, on their religious attitudes and aptitudes. But let me try to go a little further, if I may just wait on the question, by pointing out that, by the way, I think it's important to realize that one of the reasons you mentioned before about IBC, one of the reasons IBC and other similar schools have not been so successful is that there are elements of the yeshiva model that I think should be imported into anything that we do. Most importantly, the intensity of the atmosphere. I mean, there's a certain intensity in the Beit Midrash that doesn't exist in other maslulim. Another thing is the Rosh Yeshiva, the Ish Dugma, the role model of someone who spends 24 hours a day or all of his waking hours involved in intense growth in this particular situation. The growth may often be through text. But nonetheless, I think there are many facets of the yeshiva model that should be imported, and we make a great mistake by not importing it. Nonetheless, as far as the center of the yeshiva model, which emphasizes the study of Gemara, I think that there has to be challenged and looked carefully at. I mean, two other models that I think that we need to be aware of. Number one is the Torim Derech Eretz approach, which again had certain issues. One can't say it was a complete success, but certainly in terms of providing opportunities to all the others who can't master Gemara or don't want to master Gemara, and again, as opposed to the 10% of actual dropouts, I think it's more accurate to say that 75% of our children will not excel in the study of Gemara, and somewhat approximately similar percentage will not get anything religiously from the study of Gemara. We'll speak about what a person does get. I think much more than anything else, it's a question of process, but we'll get back to that point. I want to speak more about the Torah and Derech Eretz approach. One of the important things that Torah and Derech Eretz presents to us is taking away the idea that the Talmid Chacham is somehow superior to other Jews, and that particular avenue is more significant religiously. And we all know there's a famous piece in Rav Hirsch's commentary on Chumash, where he speaks about the upbringing of Esav and Yaakov, and blames Yitzchak and Rivka for not educating Esav properly by pigeonholing him into an academic learning situation. He spells it out much better in an essay. This I think is in Volume 7 of the Collected Writings of Rav Shmuel Fuller Hirsch. It's just you take a look at the entire article called Lessons from Jacob and Esau. But anyway, he has the following statement. He says, for the establishment of the kingdom, he's speaking about the Jewish kingdom, actually he calls it God's kingdom. He says, for the establishment of that kingdom requires Jewish farmers and artisans no less than Jewish scholars and sages, Jewish merchants and soldiers no less than Jewish priests and teachers. That to me spells out an equation. There's no difference in terms of the desirability, there's simply different aptitudes, and we have to address all of these aptitudes. As whether the Torah and Derech Eretz schools were actually successful in that or not, certainly the ideal is more responsive to the variety of needs that will exist in a mass situation. Again, if you're dealing with a self-selected elite of people who are interested in Gemara, as in Lithuania, and are able to master Gemara, so then you don't have to worry so much, even though there's still an issue there, you don't have to worry so much about all the people that are not interested, because they're not there. But in a school which includes everyone, again, I would say that 3/4 of the people are not really meant to be involved in this track, and therefore one has to cater to ensure their greatest Jewish development. And I think this is the underpinnings of that approach, which, again, it may not even be so important for the content as much as for the philosophy, because what underlays our approach to Jewish education is the idea that somehow creating the Talmid Chacham is what it's all really about. And if you go into the yeshiva, we're always focused in the classroom. Who does the Rebbe focus on? You know, the star. That's what's exciting, and because I remember it, when I was a ninth grade Rebbe. There was a kid who was able to speak out Rishonim before he saw them. That was very exciting. Anyway, we're going to come out with a gadol. But the problem with that is that I'm ignoring all the other students because of the excitement that such an idea creates. Very briefly, the Hasidic model, I think, is also something that we need to look more carefully at. It's interesting that more of our ancestors were Hasidic than Litvish, but for some reason, at least in the modern Orthodox world, we've generated towards the Lithuanian approach very clearly. It's interesting. I mean, in terms of the power politics that exist, the Lithuanian rabbinic leadership has exerted an undue proportion, leadership proportion that's way out of whack with its numbers, and it has to do with many variables which we're not going to touch upon now, but it's something to be aware of. Nonetheless, there's one sefer in particular that speaks very much to this issue called, it's become more popular in recent years, called the Chovat Talmidim. That's from Rav Kalonymus of Pozhizna, who lived in the 20th century, didn't live through the war, he was killed in the Holocaust. He was the...
Can you please repeat the name?
Rav Kalonymus of Pozhizna. Pozhizna is a Pozhizna Rebbe. He was in Warsaw during the war. He's considered the Rav of Warsaw. Very interesting personality. He's also known for another sefer called the Esh Kodesh. Maybe some of you.
It's Bivrit.
Okay. In any case, he speaks very much to the needs of modern children, or I should say, children living in the modern period. And it's very interesting that he's really addressing the Hasidic community more than anything else, though clearly to some extent the yeshiva community as well. But all in all, he's not speaking to Reform Jewry in Germany. He's speaking to Orthodox community of Eastern Europe, and he has some very important observations there, which I recommend everyone take a look at his introduction to this book, the Chovat Talmidim. One of the things that he brings out, I mean, the many things that he brings out, but one of the things that I want to share with you today is the idea that a person is not just a mind. And in fact, he argues that the terminology that he uses, but essentially the strings that bind us up to God are not the strings of the intellect. That there is a need for Talmud Torah, but the most important component is the emotional component, which he says can be achieved by the study, the proper study of Hasidut, right? Which is not just a question of content, though it's that also, as much as process. That there's a certain way that one teaches Hasidut from Rebbe to Talmud as well. Again, a model that I think is important in terms of meeting our needs in terms of what we want to create in a mass situation. You should realize, obviously, I'm giving this al regel echad. This is a topic that deserves many, many hours of discussion, but I'm just giving you Rashi Prakim for further thought. Now, what I want to do in the next few minutes is to sort of engage in what we call in Gemara l'ta'amech, to take on the Lithuanian world on its own assumptions and show that even according to perhaps Rav Dessler as an example, even according to those assumptions, it may not be something that we should advocate for our own contemporary setting. But rather than use Rav Dessler, I'm going to cite something more contemporary. My teacher, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who wrote an article, maybe some of you have read it, which is aptly entitled Why Learn Gemara. It's from the Lees of Faith, the first volume, is published elsewhere before. In any case, Rav Lichtenstein appropriately answers the question. And as we said before, people just sort of assume that that's what Jews are supposed to do. Granted, there was a philosophy based on Nefesh Chaim, as we spoke about, but it was very much assumed and rarely discussed. One of the great things of this article is that Rav Lichtenstein puts on the table why he, who is a representative of that school, I mean, he's obviously Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, and not by accident, and he expounds on the theoretical underpinnings of what Gemara is supposed to be doing for us or for our children. And I think, again, it's a very important piece to try to understand the other side. And I think it's very well articulated, both in terms of the goals that he sets forth, as well as in usual style, how he presents the information, first class style. But he explains the idea of dveikut b'dvar Hashem through process and the excitement that one feels on an emotional level of being engaged with dvar Hashem, specifically in the way it's done in Gemara, and presents all the things that attracted us, those of us who have learned Gemara, attracted us when we were in yeshiva, and explains the religious import of such study. But Rav Lichtenstein gives two caveats which, in my mind, really undermine his thesis, in the sense that really we should maintain the study of Gemara as the baseline, as the primary approach. Rav Lichtenstein does allow for alternative approaches to Torah study. He speaks about Mishnah, which I'm not sure is really to the point, because while it addresses the issue of the complexity of the Gemara, misses the more important point of whether the Gemara is addressing students' religious needs. And if Gemara is not addressing students' religious needs, I would imagine that Mishnah would do even less in that regard. But Rav Lichtenstein points out, number one, what we mentioned, that the study of Gemara is only appropriate for certain intellectual aptitudes. Rav Lichtenstein doesn't spell out the numbers, what that means, tachlis, what percentage of the people. One gets the sense that he's talking about a sort of remedial track, that for most people, Gemara is still what should be studied, but there are some people who, nebuch, are not on par with most of their peers, and therefore need to find some different way of relating to Torah Shebaal Peh. But more importantly, Rav Lichtenstein makes the following observation. He says as follows. He talks about the potential of what of religious experience through the study of Gemara. And he says, realization of this potential is often predicated upon faith. First, there must be faith, not mere verbal assent to dogmatic propositions, but genuine conviction and relation in the Ribono Shel Olam, in the Torah as His Word. Contact with Him and with it must be sought and appreciated as a critical desideratum. It looks like saying that if a person is not at a suitable faith level, then you can't expect Gemara to do the trick. It's not going to be Dvar Hashem if one's relationship to Hashem is weak or not there at all. One has to have what, in my mind, is a sophisticated relationship with God that exists before one can make use of this potential, as he says, that can be realized through study of Gemara. My primary argument would be that this faith level exists very rarely in our children, if in ourselves as well. It's a very interesting quote. I didn't bring it, didn't have a chance to bring it. Rav Shlomo Volba, Zal, I don't know how many have heard of him, was the great proponent of Musar in our time, and passed away, I think, 2 years ago. And a very interesting thinker. In one of his articles, he makes the following statement, and he's again speaking to the Haredi world. I mean, by and large, that was his audience, and says as follows, that faith, education of faith, is very weak in our times. He says really that faith is weak in our times, and we have to make conscious efforts to teach faith. Again, he's speaking to the Haredi world. He's not speaking to the modern Orthodox world, and says that, you know, many children who go through yeshiva, he's not talking about dropouts. He's talking about the guy who sits in the yeshiva. He says, many of these people don't really believe. Their emunah is sorely lacking. And as a result, says Rav Volbo, we have to go about and consciously teach faith. Right? Again, going back to the Chaim Soloveitchik article, what once was imbibed through one's surrounding is today something that needs to be learned throughout the Jewish community, including all segments, or at least almost all segments, of the Orthodox community. Thus, my challenge to my teacher, I have great respect for, obviously, is whether the exception that he presents for us is really ultimately the rule. You know, as he says, you know, some people can't handle it, number one, for issues of aptitude, but number two, also for issues of faith. They're not at faith level where it makes sense for them to be studying Gemara, because they're not going to create a religious experience, which Rav Lichtenstein, I think, appropriately identifies as the main point of Talmud study. It's not a question of learning text. It's not a question of mastering halakha as much as acquiring a certain type of religious experience. And I think that's right on target. The question is, who is able to create that religious experience through the study of text? And as I said, for Rav Lichtenstein, what appears to be a footnote, I would say, is in fact the overwhelming rule. That even that, what I'm calling 25% of our children who do have the aptitude to study Gemara, need to have the faith wherein study of Gemara is a productive religious experience, which I would imagine should be at the top of our mission statements, that we're not simply trying to create people who have skills, but along in conjunction with the home and as we mentioned, other elements, to create significantly religious people who have a connection with spirituality and the divine. Yeah.
So how do you marshal this argument against those who would maintain the current curriculum with the addendum that, well, we'll get these guys through high school, we'll get them to Israel, and then there they'll have the...
Right. Right.
Which, well, but how do you
which
do
we
it?
Hear, I mean, which we hear...
Right, that's standard. That's standard fare. I mean, I don't know how many people are involved in high schools, but this is the standard line which anybody who's involved in high school realizes. That is, if there were to be a real mission statement, as opposed to this fancy ideological mission statement, the real statement of most high schools is to get them to Israel for that year or two, where, in fact, there will be some sort of religious development. Well, what I would say to that is that they should really carefully examine what's going on in this year of religious development in Israel. Yes, there is a certain sense of Torah Lishma. Yes, there is a shadow of what Rav Lichtenstein is describing. Nonetheless, I think that any serious religious Jew would feel that what comes out of even the two-year experience is really a sorry ideal of what we're expecting from our students. And one of the major reasons for that is because through junior high school and high school, all we're trying to do is sort of maintain the status quo to make sure they can get to a yeshiva where this supposed religious growth takes place. It's a hard sell for a lot of reasons. And one of the things that we're dedicated to is to try to make the sell. I mean, my colleague, Rabbi Cardozo, once said to me that if you bang your head against the wall often enough, eventually the wall falls down. I think there's truth to that. There's formidable opposition for all sorts of reasons against major curricular change. You're asking me. I'm biased. I think there's some. Put it this way. I think there are some good reasons. I think that the major good reason, which is not usually mentioned, I don't think it's on the agenda, at least consciously, is fear. Fear meaning, okay, we have something that's not bad. You're telling me try something else. What if it's worse? I think that's a real issue. I mean, one of my nightmares is being successful and then seeing that the alternative is worse than what we have. I mean, that is scary. That is scary. But in my mind, it's not the way one lives one's life. One has to try to do what is the best, and if you fail, you fail at least trying to improve the world. But I was just going to mention another practical thing, which again some of you might have run into, is the economic competition that principals face, certainly in this area. I'm in Los Angeles, also anywhere where there's a competitive situation, where one of the ways you compete is by offering the parents what presumably they want, is that they go to the best schools, meaning not just Harvard, but Midrashet Lindenbaum and Gush Etzion, Shalavim, whatever is popular nowadays. Principals know that if they're creating alternative maslulim, which prevents many numbers of students from going to these yeshivot and going to sort of experimental programs which are out there, they're going to lose a lot of students, and their board is not going to be very happy with them. Yeah.
The modern Orthodox faith school that I've been teaching at, I don't see, and we are changing our Toshbuk curriculum. I think one problem with Gemara is not Gemara, but we're doing it too early before the kids are ready. And also, like, I think from what I understand, the yeshivish method was, if you're in it long enough, you're going to pick up the skills and be able to do it without actually teaching
how to learn.
Step by step how to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's the same thing with Tanakh. I mean, if it's always taught in, you know, you can always look at the English and this and the other, you never get it, you know, you never get it. But these kids, a lot of these kids, even those that aren't, say, the Talmidei Chachamim, all right, they're going to go on to good colleges. And why should they, I mean, the aim of the parents is to get them into a very good college, all right? Why should they go into college with any less background in textual study in the Limudei Kodesh than they have in the Limudei Chol, where they can open up a book and they can, you know, they can read anything in English and figure it out? Why should we give them the background in the language of both Tanakh and Gemara so that they can, so they're just as literate?
I'll answer your question in more detail in a couple of minutes, but I would just serve up as a counter question. Based on the presumption that I disagree with the notion that simply how it's taught, I agree. If we're going to teach Gemara, we should do it right. And I agree with both of the points you made that should be taught later and systematically, absolutely. But I would ask you, when you're speaking about literacy, whether we teach all of our students nuclear physics so that they'd be literate in nuclear physics. Gemara is an extremely difficult limud. It's something that to master, I mean, exposure is one thing. I think all the students should have exposure to Gemara. As far as serious study of Gemara, it takes years. Most of the guys that come out of 2-3 years post-high school programs are still not really literate in Talmud and Halakha. On some level, I think it's a waste of our resources unless there's something very important on a religious level that's to be gotten out of such a study. Yeah?
Is there anyone who's accepting teaching Gemara in Hebrew, with Hebrew serving as a bridge between what they may be familiar with somewhat and Aramaic?
Yeah, again, that's not what I'm looking at. You're right. There is.
If considering how it could be more effective, perhaps.
Right.
You know, instituting more rigorous Hebrew.
100%. But I had this argument with Jeff Sachs, who's the director of Atid, and they speak about all sorts of ways of improving the system. We at the Cordoza Academy speak about changing the system. He said to me, you probably look at me as someone who advocates pushing around the deck chairs on the Titanic. I think there's some truth to that analysis. I think that we need to go back and analyze all of our options. If we come in with the assumption that we have to teach Talmud, then I agree with your suggestion, I agree with this woman's suggestion. My question is, let's first ascertain that that's really the case. My sense is that it's not. I wouldn't do away completely with Talmud. I'm telling you, perhaps the next couple of minutes, the way I would envision a curriculum. But there's a couple...
You know, could you just do that? Because I really think
that's
the issue.
That's the issue.
How do you teach okay. it? I mean, or what?
Okay, Let me do the following to try to please as many people as possible. Let me just finish what I want to say and then allow for questions and discussion. So I think the issue, if we're correct, is to go from a faith-assuming curriculum to a faith-building curriculum. That if that's the central issue, if spirituality is a question of faith, I'm not just talking about proving God as much as creating a relationship with God, which I see at the center of faith. Faith as experiential as opposed to intellectual. Then I think that the pyramid that we have in our schools should be flipped on its head. How does one teach faith is again, is an issue that doesn't deserve 10 minutes, deserves much more, and something that if we do bang our heads against the wall and have people listen to us, we can finally really open up such a discussion on a serious level. At this point, it's really pockets of people here, pockets of people there, they're talking about it, and we're not giving it our greatest effort. So I'm just going to throw out a couple crumbs on some level to tell you what I'm thinking. But I think certainly to start with, larger issues have to be taught. Larger issues such as truth, larger issues such as beauty, larger issues such as ethics, and so on and so forth. I think we should teach it through text, but not only through text. I think we need to teach this experientially as well, going back to the Hasidic model. Though I wouldn't teach Hasidut per se. I think that's not a model that we can completely emulate. But in any case, when we decide what text to teach, I think we need to be looking for that. Tanakh certainly lends itself more readily to the larger issues, not every section. But in many sections. I mean, I spend a lot of time teaching Bereishit. Bereishit, one of the reasons I teach it so much is because you have the Derech Eretz Kadma LeTorah in Sefer Bereishit. You have all sorts of issues that are on people's minds and should be on people's minds. Obviously, Agadata, Midrash, as well as the non-halachic sections of the Talmud, which we often skip. Right, so I think a friend of mine said he does the opposite. I think we should be doing the opposite in the schools. We should be teaching the Agadah and skipping the Halacha. Halacha needs to be learned, but I don't think we need to learn it in its original source, except for those people who are going to be the rabbinic and intellectual leaders, or at least a part of that leadership. I think we should develop sugyot that are, again, value-based, that are issue-based, that are spirituality-based. Again, I think what I'm arguing for is first setting up our priorities. What are we trying to accomplish at schools? And I would suggest we need to think as broadly as possible. And we need to think in tabula rasa-type terms. We need to think fresh slate, as if we're recreating Jewish education. Because ultimately, I think that's to the benefit of the Jewish people to give the best product that most suits our needs, as opposed to sort of muddling through, as Jews often do. I mean, Medinat Yisrael is the greatest example of muddling through, where nothing is ever thought about ahead of time till we confront a situation and we manage. And Baruch Hashem, Shomer Ptaim Hashem, Hashem always helps us out, so to speak, and we somehow survive. I think when it comes to Jewish education, we live our lives very much in that way, to our detriment. The last point I want to make, there is one important issue that does remain outstanding and will need to be addressed, assuming we do win the curriculum wars, as they're called, and that is that we do need some people who are masters of Talmudic and Halachic texts. And again, the argument of Rav Dessler, basing himself on Midrash, where the Midrash speaks about 1,000 people entering the Beit Midrash, and various numbers dropping out so that we can create one Gadol, there is some truth to that social pressure to succeed in Gemara helps adolescents desire to achieve in Talmud, as it does in any other area. Why is basketball popular among kids? Because it's popular among other kids. There's prestige. And so too, and certainly in the post-high school situation, there's prestige to being a Lamdan. If we're assuming, as we would like to propose, that we're cutting out 75% or more of our children from Talmud study, there's much less prestige in it. And I think that is an issue that will need to be addressed if, in Yirat Hashem, we're able to have the day. I mean, I think there are ways that there's other incentives that can be created, both financial and otherwise, to encourage people to become Talmid Chachamim, even if we don't have social pressure. I'm going to take some questions now.
One of the questions, the nice thing about the current model is that I don't particularly care who's teaching my kid what not bar not means, or what rov means, or what tradition are. I'm much more concerned that who's going to be sort of teasing out lessons from gracious. And there's a great concern to me, if you was this model, how exactly are you going to vet or decide who's going to be doing it? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
It's not just a matter here of, are you capable? I mean, I saw a little bit, I saw more than in Tanakh.
Yeah.
But in Tanakh, in talking to peers who've done in the past, I was horrified by the approach that some people were teaching, taking to the same thing I was teaching.
Right.
That seems to me an issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. I would argue that that's an important issue, whether we change curriculum or not. The Rebbe is a mashpia, whether he's a mashpia via what he's teaching or whether he's being mashpia by his personal approach to Yiddishkeit, he's a mashpia. And if we're concerned, I think on some level it might even be easier to be able to teach one's child that the Rebbe's approach to Midrash is not an approach that I agree with, than to say that the Rebbe's approach to life is not an approach that I agree with. So I think the issue is going to stay around no matter what. I mean, I know that we have a major problem, especially in this country, where in the modern Orthodox school, we have, especially at the elementary school level, we don't have a modern Orthodox staff. And so it's a real problem. And I think sort of quarantining them to Talmud skills is not so effective. So I'm not sure the problem is one that only would apply, but it's a serious problem. Yeah?
One thing gives us hope. You put it out there as hypothetical. So I work in Hebrew Academy here in Washington. I'll tell you answer very briefly. But one of our competitions is the Yeshiva of Greater Washington, where there's a heavy focus on the Talmud program. And certainly parents had it in the approach that if you didn't have the double Talmud for the boys, they wouldn't be able to get into the top Yeshiva parents. So the realization was that the double Talmud wasn't working for 2/3 of the group. So in 11th and 12th grade, there's now a curriculum which is one period Talmud, one period called Kodesh. And to some extent, the Rebbe who's developed this program happens to be the Mashgiach Ruchani, so there's less of a concern about who's actually teaching it. And he's doing Kari Emunah. He's doing some very interesting things. And we've used multimedia. Theodore Bikel was in D.C. last year doing the dissertation. So we got to see the Ramban perform live performance. It was unbelievable. In the 9th and 10th grade, what we've done is we've co-opted as we're the girls' curriculum, and they're now doing another class in the second period. So back on the ground, it's happening. And the only issue is not that parents accept or don't accept the curriculum. They want to honor the designation. That's the big concern. But as far as shifting away from Gemara, that has been well accepted by the school community.
Can you rebel? Yeah, go ahead. No, this gentleman. Oh, go ahead.
Rabbi Lichtenstein's theory is very much like a Hasidic.
Why?
From what he told us, because he told us that they accepted the literature way of education. By Lichtenstein ourselves already, they are the literature, right?
Right.
They represent the literature.
Right.
And he also talks about the faith.
Yeah, no,
religious experience.
Sure, but
so that this is the Hasidic.
I don't think so. I think that he's simply expounding the bottom line to the Litvish approach. The Litvish approach is not divorced from God. It appears divorced from God. But there's certainly an idea that my praise of Lichtenstein is that he's explaining that it's not simply a text issue. But that, in fact, if you look at Halachic Man, which is Relay Soloveitchik, if you look at the Nefesh Chaim, you can't get more Litvish than Nefesh Chaim. Speaks about all the time, and that's the main point of the book. Absolutely. The Litvish agree with that. The question is how you get to it. That's the question.
And also the children learn more through emulating.
100%.
Not so much, but you teach them.
Correct.
So that the self-example, the role model,
right.
The teacher, the educator, 100%. Is very important.
100%.
And I think that in this, they both are the same. The Hasidic also said the same thing. That's the experience. I am Hasidic only if I'm saying. And I remember more how my Beis Yaakov teacher, student Davin,
but sure, 100%. It's a different topic, but it's
we have to go by this.
I agree.
And also, I think you didn't give your credit to the influence what this young man said there about the home. Because if the home contradicts us, then we cannot do our job as well.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
In breaking down the curriculum to faith assuming and faith building, which I think is a fascinating way to look at it, I think you made an equation between the faith building curriculum and Rav Chaim Shmuel Paul Hirsch, the Torah of Derech Eretz. Has there been anyone since who has assumed the mantle of this faith building curriculum as a necessity?
I think other people have mentioned the Esh Kodesh. I think the Esh Kodesh, I think certainly in the Hasidic world, you definitely have that as the focus. You have other people, I think Rav Kook on some level, who's somewhere between worlds. But facts on the ground, I said the people who have influenced our educational system are not these people. They're great Gedolim, but very much ensconced in the Lithuanian approach of reaching God through Talmud Torah. Yeah, I think last question.
I have a question as follows. Assuming that someone wants to take the Lithuanian approach and concentrate on as the vehicle to convince what the Ebonish are on, what would be the vehicle for success in Lilith Hatara? What would be the vehicle of success to the vehicle that women should take?
Oh, I mean, you're assuming that women shouldn't be. I mean, I'm not sure.
I'm looking at historical development, and I mean, if
in their time, in a time when women didn't learn Gemara, you're asking?
I mean, if
yeah, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting question.
So I look at Shahalacha.
Right. So, where's the role for women?
And I know how the Rav Zatzal. First of all, I'm a Bostonian, so I know how the Rav Zatzal talked about both his wife Alayashlam and his mother Alayashlam.
Right.
And they were formidable intellectual people.
Nachon.
Both, as is his daughter.
Yeah.
I should say, as are his daughter.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But what's the religious vehicle for the Veikut?
It's not the same question. I don't have an answer.
Okay.
It's a good question, but but it's certainly an issue, and perhaps the answer wouldn't be one we would like to hear. But it's an open question. It's an open question. I want to thank you all. And there's information about our program, David Cardozo Academy, if you're interested in hearing more about it. We send out weekly emails. Anybody wants to sign up for? We'd love to send you more information.
I do.
Where are you located? In Jerusalem.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oops, guys. Work to you.
So you, in your institution, this is a budget, right?
This is, we teach teachers. Future teachers.
Are you familiar with the Bar Chai system?
I used to be a principal in the Bar Chai system.
That's so, right. Is it more or less as a budget?
Has nothing to do with Bar Chai. It has nothing to do with Bar Chai. Again, Bar Chai is method, and I think the method is correct. But what we're dealing with is not so much method as much as radical change.
So you would change, go beyond Bar Chai?
I would go beyond Bar Chai.
But Bar Chai would be a starting point?
Bar Chai is good. Bar Chai is an effective way of learning Jewish text the way I think should be learned through age 18. But it's not faith building. In other words, it's better technically in the yeshiva model. But as far as what we're talking about today, it really doesn't make that much of a difference. It's a little more Tanakh, but...
So this is, you're talking about how the teachers should be trained in order to in order to build faith.
That's right. That's right.
Your card?
Yeah.
Do you have any other way of reaching, receiving your materials other than by email?
You can put a fax number. You can put a fax number.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you. What's your name?
Shlomo Gewurz. Pleasure to meet you.
Gewurz. Someone mentioned the name Gewurz to me, and I know Gewurz, but I don't know. It wasn't you.
No. Probably not.
Excuse me. You just say that one sentence. Reaching God through... Reaching God through Talmud Torah.
Right.
Say this is the opposite way.
Yeah. Talmud Torah through reaching God.